There's Gina Rostwald in high school.
Jessica Medvick.
Lauren McGee.
Today is April 27th, 2007.
Today we're interviewing Mr.
Stan Pryor.
Okay, how old were you when the war was
about
going on?
10 and a half.
10 and a half?
Yeah.
Did you witness any major events or tragic moments during the war?
Not really. My cousin volunteered for the Air Force. He lied about his age, so he was piloting a bomber over Italy when he was about 17 and was just missing in action. But that's about the only tragedy in my family, luckily.
Yeah.
But the rest of it is just bombing. Was about the only thing I witnessed.
Were you ever scared that you were going to get bombed?
Are kids that age ever scared?
Did you ever think that you would have to be in the military?
Well, I knew that right from the beginning. Depending on how long the war lasted, but it wasn't likely to last from 10 and a half till 18. Mm-hmm. But I knew pretty well always that there would be a draft and everybody would be called up for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And when I was called up, they had just started reducing it from 2 years to 18 months, and they got down to 1 year and 11 months. And then something happened somewhere in the British Empire that they added another couple of months onto it. Mm-hmm. But there was no real major thing.
Was your dad involved in the war?
Or what?
Was your dad or uncles there?
My two uncles were in the Air Force regiment, which meant they were guarding airfields. Mm-hmm. And one of those was wounded. My two cousins, one of them, I think, got a deferment or something, but the other one was out in Africa and he picked up a particularly bad case of some sort of malaria. Okay. And he was never quite the same after that.
Yeah.
My father was way too old. He was in the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever hear of the Battle of Jutland, he was in that one.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, but that's about all for my family, I think.
Mm-hmm. Was there any economical differences after the war?
Before the war, we were kind of in the depression, the same as you were over here, or the people were over here. And then the war, of course, gave everybody a job and more money. And that was when the unions became very powerful. And they would, when I was working, even we would get cost of living increases every year. And that was pretty well automatic, and it was based on inflation. So we might get 6% increase this year and 8% the next year without actually doing anything.
Yeah.
But that was about all. There were probably war profiteers and things like that, but mm-hmm. nothing that I was aware of.
Maybe you want to start by talking about that childhood period, or did you already do that?
I just told them, shall I start?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go back a little before the war. We were a working class family. We lived in a very small house, no central heating. Before the war, and in those days, TV had just got started. My uncle was the only one in our family who had a TV set, and it was about yay big with curved sides. They stopped that transmission during the war. So we basically had newspapers and the radio. And the radio and TV were monopolies of our local post office. And they issued licenses and stuff like that. So there were only two radio stations, really. There were BBC Home Service, which was classical and stuff like that, and the BBC Light program, which during the war gave the lighter music and the music while you work and the comedies and all the rest of it, keep people's spirits up, I guess. There was one kind of pirate station, I think it was on a ship somewhere off the coast, Radio Luxembourg. They had commercials. And we had, it wasn't quite the same as Tokyo Rose, but there was a Lord Haw-Haw who was obviously British, broadcasting for the Germans. But we were, even before the war, very well informed because of the radio and newspapers and the fact that there wasn't a whole lot else to do. So we knew all about Neville Chamberlain's efforts to appease Hitler and the Germans. Back up a bit. The First World War, the Germans signed the Treaty of Versailles and they weren't allowed to build ships, boats, tanks or anything else, and they had to give reparations to the Allies, and that crippled the whole country, and it led to a... led to a whole lot of bad feeling, and eventually when Hitler came into power, everybody followed him because he could give them work. They were building everything that they weren't supposed to build, but of course nobody in the rest of the world wanted to challenge them. And then he started invading other countries or occupying them, and he started off with anything close by to Germany that had a majority of German citizens, like Austria, the Sudetenland, things like that. Then he went into, and of course the population were just greeting them like heroes, and then he went into Czechoslovakia, and the British started saying, no more, no more. And he had this blitzkrieg idea where they want to go into a country, they bomb it, strafe it with airplanes, just drive right through it with tanks. And they could get through a country in Europe in like a couple of days. So when they were finished occupying Czechoslovakia, is this, have I lost you?
No.
Okay. if you want to hear something else or you have questions, just interrupt me. Okay, so after that, Hitler attacked Poland, and we said, no, that's the line, can't do that. So we declared war on them. And for several months there, it was what they called a phony war, that nothing really happened. And that was when Winston Churchill came into power, fortunately. And then after a few months, the raid started. And they were bombing, they didn't really care very much whether they bombed civilians or anything else. It was just to fly towards a center of population like London and just drop everything you can. So that there was an awful lot of damage, especially they had some targets like the docks along the Thames, obviously very strategically important. So there were some areas that got hit very badly.
People die.
Yeah, quite a lot. Yeah, they have a metro system there, underground railway, and they use those stations as air raid shelters. There would be people sleeping in those days on end if they had to. The homeowners, they had two kinds of air raid shelters which they gave us. We had what they called a Morrison shelter, which was basically an open framework of very heavy pipe, iron with a very thick steel plate on top. So it was about, 6 by 8 feet, and our family slept in there if there was a raid. We had just one big mattress in there and crawled in at night. The other one was the Anderson, which was more or less like a Quonset hut that you could bury halfway in the ground, and then the earth you took out from there you piled on top of it. Nothing would withstand a direct hit, but it was some protection. And then outside our house in the road, they built some communal shelters, just brick with concrete roof. Okay, again, it wouldn't withstand a direct hit. And the other thing they did, so that if a bomb landed on a local school, it wouldn't wipe everybody out in the town. So we were split up between, like, my class was everybody on our road and another couple of roads, and we met in a church hall with just one teacher, a really good teacher. And that was about a mile away from what the other school. Luckily, none of them ever got hit, but if, you know, it did protect us from having too many kids wiped out from the same neighborhood. Let's see.
Sorry. You're talking about them bombing other Germans, just bombing arbitrarily.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the war.
Well, all through the war. Basically, I think what happened with the German air raids was that they started out really nobody opposing them, so they could come over any time, day or night, bring the fighters with them and just create absolute havoc. Then the British airport Air Force wasn't very big, but they made it quite efficient by having spotters around the coast so that they could see and hear the planes coming over, and they would alert by phone, they would alert the airfields where the fighters were, so they could be up and directed to that particular group of planes that were coming over and do some good without, if they tried to be everywhere, you'd have one plane against 50 sort of thing. So in that way we were able to do a lot of damage in some nights, and they would announce this on the radio, there'd be 100 German planes shot down in a night. So and eventually they had to give up sending the fighters over, so the bombers were coming over escorted, so then they started night raids only. And eventually, with all the stuff that was going on in Europe, the Germans just couldn't keep up with the losses, and they needed those planes elsewhere, especially when Hitler was stupid enough to invade Russia. You know, he had there's so many things that he did that helped the British without meaning to. So anyway, we had the daylight raids, and then the night raids, and then that cooled off, and then we had the guided bombs. The first one to come over was what we called the buzz bomb. It was more like the drones you have now, I think, just a fuselage with a little tail and stubby wings and a little jet engine at the back. And that was the first real use of the jet engine. A lot of this stuff was just coming in, jet engines and radar and stuff like that. And they would launch those out of Holland on ramps. The thing would go up here, and it was controlled by gyroscope, so it would just go in the direction that the ramp was, and it would go until it ran out of fuel. So it was kind of aimed at London somewhere, and when we heard them coming over, we'd look and we could see them in the sky, and we knew when the noise stopped, they were going to go right like that. So we had time to, you know, being kids, we were all out there. We had time to get under cover. So the only damage we got to our house was one of the ceilings was cracked, so that had to be replaced, but we were fortunate. After that, and I think again it was in the North Country somewhere, Holland, Belgium, somewhere like that, they had what they called the V2s. The buzz bombs were V1s, the rockets were V2s. And you ever heard of Wernher von Braun, the rocket scientist? Well, once the war was over, the Americans got hold of all of the rocket scientists that had been working on these things and convinced them to come to the States so the Russians wouldn't get them. And the people working on those V-2 rockets were like that. And those, they probably had like a couple of kilos of explosive in them. They could do a lot of damage, and there was no defense against them. There was no real defense against the buzz bombs, except that the British pilots would try and get close and flip their wings to take it off balance so it would dive there, but They lost a few of the British pilots doing that to get too close. But the V-2s, they just went up, and the first thing you knew about them was an explosion, an enormous explosion. And then immediately after that you'd hear this because it was going faster than sound, so the noise of their approach would be after their explosion, if you can imagine that basic law of, you know, Einstein and all that kind of stuff. So that was the extent of the attack on London or the London area. We were on the outskirts, luckily. As far as everyday living, we had, one thing I did bring, everything was in short supply in England, so the newspapers ended up this size.
Okay.
No ads, very few pictures.
Mainly about the war.
Oh yeah, it was just, basically it was just news. Didn't get a funny page or anything else. But Britain had very few trees, so the houses were mostly cinder block. They couldn't really supply themselves in food, so there was a lot of rationing. We had, the meat was rationed by cost. In other words, you could have, say, a shilling's worth of meat a week. And then it was up to you. For that, you could either get maybe 3/4 of a pound of stewing meat or an ounce of steak. That was your choice. But that was a fair way of doing it, because that meant the rich people didn't get most of the good stuff. We kept chickens at home, and so we had our own eggs, and we used to kill the chickens each Christmas and give one to each member of the family. That was our Christmas gift. Being food, very welcome. Butter was very rationed. In fact, we had a family recipe that, well, I don't know where it came from, but I used to sit for hours beating this damn stuff. We get the butter nice and soft and then keep beating milk and gelatin into it until you got it about an extra 50% of something that was kind of like butter. Margarine, or what you call oleo, I guess, was available, but they didn't allow them to color it, so it was kind of like lard more than oleo. What else? Sugar. It's funny at the beginning of the war, for some reason or other, I went off sugar, and the rest of the family were delighted because they had my sugar ration, what little candy was available, stuff like that. Milk, I think, was always available, and bread. But a lot of the things that you take for granted these days, clothing was another thing. When I got to, I think it was, I was about 11 and a half, I got to the 11 plus exam where they decide whether you're going to go to a regular school or where. And I got a scholarship to we call them public schools, you might call them private schools. And in normal times they had a school uniform. But because of the rationing of clothing, I was only forced to wear a cap, which pleased my father because he didn't want to spend money on a uniform. And the cap he bought me, I think, from what I remember, it was over my ears when I started, and it was up here when I finished. 5 years later, we made everything last. What else?
Can I ask you a question on
that? Sure. Oh yeah, any time, any or you want.
Too young to have it affect you, but what about like the Holocaust?
The Holocaust?
We
heard about it.
Yeah.
It didn't affect us because none of the Jews were taken out of England.
Yeah, just your like degree of awareness about it, I think.
Yeah. So, we were aware of it, and something I can't understand is these people that still insist that that didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to, as a tourist, I've been to Dachau, and you know, we see all the photos and everything else. It happened, but we, at the time, couldn't do anything about it until we liberated the camps.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Okay. Let's see. Okay, because of the draft, I guess most of the civilian work was done by either individuals who were older or not very fit, or women, or exempted as being in the essential parts. So, at the time my father was working at a factory down the road that repaired Wellington bombers, they would come in off their raids, and they had this geodetic construction, little triangles, so they could take an awful lot of damage and just the skin would get broken, so they would repair those and send them back out again. Mm-hmm. Oh, gasoline was very... It was available to some extent for people like doctors who had to be on the road. Mm-hmm. But generally very little petrol. We had very strict blackout regulations, mm-hmm. so we had old drapes and things all around. Mm-hmm. They had air raid wardens who would come out around at night and put that light out and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
The home guard that trained with wooden rifles. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of things like that. We had the woman's land army, the gals that were running the farms basically because the men weren't available. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Vehicles had, they had light headlights, but they were basically covered in black with a couple of slits in, so they were virtually useless. Mm-hmm. They might show somebody else that there's something there, but they wouldn't show you the way.
Was the general feeling in Britain then, like, pretty patriotic? Everybody really excited to be a part for the war?
Yeah. Yeah, because we were well aware of what England was facing if Germany ever invaded. And that was one of the big fears, really, that we could beat the Germans in the air, but invasion would be a real problem. And I think they did have one attempt at invasion, because there were a few bodies and things washed up on the shore, but they never really got anywhere. But yeah, there was a great deal of patriotic feeling, because everybody was in it. There wasn't a case of rich kids avoiding the draft and the poor going or anything like that. Everybody was in it, and they knew we needed to win. There's no alternative.
Did the women in your family do much for the war?
I'm sorry?
Did the women in your family do much for the war?
Yeah, there were women branches of the forces. There was the WACS, Women's Auxiliary Air Corps, the WAFs, the Women's Auxiliary Army, something or other, and the WRENS, which was the Women's Royal Naval Service. So, yeah, there were those three services. Well, Princess, the present Queen Elizabeth was in the Auxiliary Territorial Service or something like that. She used to drive people around and repair the trucks and things. And there were a lot. And we had the equivalent of Rosie the Riveter and a lot of people doing heavy work that before the war they wouldn't have even asked a woman to do. So, yeah, they really pulled their weight. And luckily, I think that gave them an entry into better jobs and a better attitude from everyone else. So. Some of our kids, I was talking to the other speaker before this, some of our kids were evacuated to the States or Canada, and I always wondered whether there was any of those that were lost at sea, because the U-boats would just ship sink anything, whether it had a big red cross or anything else on it. A lot of them were evacuated into the country, so they stayed with farm families. They had, at least in the London area, and I think it was pretty well true anywhere in England, they had very good public transportation. And that's one of the things that I've missed in this country. I think when cars were first becoming popular, the auto manufacturers and the oil companies decided that they would really lobby hard for roads, so you've got this big network of roads. Whereas in England and the European countries, you can get on a bus, a tram, a train, streetcar, anything. When we go over to Europe, we would generally stay about 20, 30 miles outside of the big city like Rome or places like that, and just use public transportation to get in. And I sort of miss that here because it's really hard to get people off the road. Mm-hmm. It really is.
Fuel, gas prices.
Well, they have to do it eventually, I guess. Yeah, we had a small car before the war, and that stayed on blocks all through the war in the garage. It was rather ironic. My father never gave anything away, but he sold that for £10. As soon as the war was over, he sold it for £10. 3 months later, when gas was available again, they were selling them for £200. Yep. Anybody, at the beginning of the war especially, anybody that had aluminum cookware for saucepans, things like that, they donated those to the corps because they could be used to make new aeroplanes, you know, aluminum stuff. Had a lot of savings bonds and stamps. The kids would pick up shrapnel in the street. And we could see the dogfights, the fighters, and the fires at night. Everybody was given a gas mask and told how to use it, because in the First World War, the Germans used poison gas. Mm-hmm. And there was a great fear that they would do the same thing in the Second World War, but I think they were aware that if they did, so would we. And that kind of thing could really backfire on the person that starts it. So we didn't ever have to use the gas masks, but we had those.
Mm-hmm. What about the blackout things where you put the black shades on?
Well, we used whatever we could. It was hard to get any new material to use, because of the restrictions on clothing and all the rest of it that apply to anything made of cloth. So we might have to use whatever we had, plus blankets, tablecloths, anything, and very dim lights.
Mm-hmm. What was that for?
What was it for?
Yeah.
Well, if you've got a town where you don't have a blackout, you go over in a plane, you can see all the lights. Mm-hmm. It'll be, even if it's just a dull glow from the lights in houses, you can still see that and say, yeah, that's something to hit. Mm-hmm. So that was the only reason for it.
Mm-hmm. I just wasn't sure, exactly how come. In the United States at the time, a lot more movies and music was becoming more popular. What do you remember about that during that time in Britain? What movies were popular and what popular culture do you remember?
Oh, I didn't go to the movies all that often, and of course there was no TV, so it was probably real simple-minded stuff, and all the feel-good stuff.
Sports and...
Yeah. When the American forces started to come over, everybody breathed a sigh of relief, and I think I upset somebody in the Historical Society by saying this, but the American forces were extremely welcomed, but the trouble is that they were paid a lot more than our boys, and they had all the chocolates and nylons and all the rest of it, and the few of our fellas that were still around couldn't compete, you know, so that's why they had so many warmerides coming over, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You said your family lived on the outskirts of London?
Yeah.
So did a lot of families move out of the city because of the threat of air raids?
I don't think they had the choice, really. There wouldn't be anything for them to buy to live in. So they had to just stay there and suffer and hide in the shelters and the underground railways and things like that.
Was your home on a farm? Because you mentioned...
No. It was... When we moved in there, when I was probably 7, something like that, it was a brand new subdivision. And our house and the others on the street really were maybe 500 square feet, really tiny. So that was, yeah, pretty well out in the country, but then of course it slowly got built up. There were the older houses along the other side of the road, and then our subdivision. And we all had long, narrow lots that went all the way to the railroad at the bottom. So the lots were probably 30 feet wide, but 100 feet long. And last time I was back there, I found that a developer had bought up the back halves of these gardens, and there were new roads and houses back there. If you can imagine putting all that stuff in about 50 feet, so it's real crowded. But it's slowly, yeah, I used to, when I was a kid, I used to work for an old farmer and just mile down the road. But that's long gone. Well, it's kind of like, what is it, Thomas, or the guy that keeps cows in Tigard, and everybody is waiting for him to die or move out or something so they could grab the land. But there's, yeah, it's all very built up now. Yeah.
Was it difficult to find work?
Not once the war started. No, there was work for anybody that could do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
After the war, did people lose jobs? Like, did the women lose jobs? Like, the men who were in the military that came back?
They came back, and the money was a lot better then, so it was probably optional, really, that anybody who was married, if they didn't want their wife to work, or the wife didn't want to work, they had that option then, they could stay home. There were probably quite a lot that emigrated, and there were new industries. They needed cars. They hadn't built any cars since 39, so they had all that to catch up on, and so did you over here. So, yeah, there always seemed to be jobs. I got one quite easily.
What was your job?
Well, funny you should ask that. When I left school, my father insisted that I apply at the local oil company. It was called Anglo-Iranian Oil Company then. Five more minutes?
About 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay, just getting into my stride. Anyway, I applied there and they didn't say anything, so I went into a local dairy in their labs, in the research lab. And then I got into the oil company and went over to Iran for a year until they kicked the British out. And then when I came back, I got into, since I'd been, are we keeping you up? No. Never mind.
What?
Just asked if we were keeping you up.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's fine. Anyway, where was I? I shouldn't do that.
Coming back from Iran.
Oh, yeah, and I'd had enough of the oil industry, so I got into electronics then, and I've been in there for my entire career.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so, but never a lack of job.
Do you still have friends you met during the war? Do you still, like, keep correspondence with people in that kind of war?
No. Well, that's one thing that I still regret, and there's another thing that you might bear in mind. I didn't keep any documents, photos, any of that stuff, never kept a journal, so I have to rely on my memory as to what happened during those years. Now I've got it all pretty well written down. But I wish I had some photos. There weren't that many about that, though. If you were lucky, you had a box brownie. But photos. When I was in Iran, and I was trying to apply to come into this country, well, that was afterwards, but when I tried to come into this country, I had to give them documentation for everywhere I was. So I included this stint in Iran. I said, I've got no proof of that, so they Americans said, oh, don't worry about it. They looked in their book and it said it's difficult to obtain and of doubtful value. But I wrote to the head of Interpol in Tehran, and about a year later I got this document saying that they didn't know anything bad about me. So, but even that I didn't have the sense to save. So, yeah, if you have the opportunity, keep track of your life and stack away stuff to document it.
Sometimes I think I have a little too much stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's fine.
I wrote this story at first grade.
Put it all on a disc. Anyway, I don't know that there was anything else. Dunkirk, we were very aware of Dunkirk, where we got out most of our army back, fortunately. Again, Hitler was sitting there and he stopped his army from attacking us, and I don't know why, but we got most of our army back from France. And because of the radio, we could tell how things were going in North Africa, where Montgomery was fighting Rommel, and gradual move into Italy and all the rest of it. So the whole thing was very alive for us.
How did you feel about
D-Day? Fine. It was the only way the war was going to get finished. We were a bit concerned because a lot of what we did was being dictated more or less by the Russians, who were really pushing hard for us to open what they called a second front. Their first front was getting close to Stalingrad, so they wanted us to attack Europe so that they would have some of the German troops diverted. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, yeah, it was a real bloody conflict at first. I know the Americans on Omaha Beach and the others, they lost an awful lot of people. And I think generally we got accurate and complete information. It wasn't really too heavily slanted. I know when I was in Iran, we had access to all of the local papers that were available in England. Well, it was just the Sunday paper, actually. And there was only one, there was a lot of trouble in those days when they were throwing the British out. There was only one newspaper that consistently reported the things that we were seeing. And that was, in those days, it was called the Manchester Guardian. It's called the Guardian now. But the others weren't bad, were a little bit sensational. So I think we were getting good information. Oh, that's... During the war, when the Americans came in, that's when I learnt to love spam and hate peanut butter. we did learn something from our previous conflicts, like we didn't go around the battlefields wearing red coats and kilts for the Scots and identifying the officers so they'd becoming instant targets. That was rationing cuisine. Cooking, yeah, that's where British cooking got a bad name. You can imagine you can't import very much, so there was lots of stuff that would grow in a lousy climate. Cabbage, root vegetables. You've probably heard of English bangers, haven't you, the sausage? That used to be meat, and then it became, during the war, it became half cereal of some kind. And the British seem to have developed a taste for that, so they've never gone away from it. So their sausages over there are still not very good. Let's see. Yeah, everything, of course, was seasonal. We did have a fair amount of fish because there's nothing in England, I don't think, more than about 70 miles from the coast, and that was before overfishing.
Well, sorry, I think we've used enough of your time. Yeah. Thanks for talking to us.
Oh, you're welcome.